新型コロナウイルス感染拡大に。
Without the pandemic, the Olympic Games would be an amazing opportunity to unite people. But unfortunately, the pandemic could not allow us to hold events with full spectators. We are very sorry for the locals living near the Olympic venues.
Seiko Hashimoto, the president of Tokyo's Olympic Organizing Committee, after her country's prime minister declared a state of emergency that will last throughout the games, games that begin in 2 weeks. We're going to talk about what that means and what the Olympics will look like in a few minutes. First, though, let's take a look at the restaurant business locally. COVID really did a number on it. Nearly a third of California's restaurants went out of business. A million jobs were lost. So what does the recovery look like? Well, so far, not great. Restaurants have been struggling to rehire staff, both wait staff and kitchen staff. Many have had to cut back hours because of that, and that means less money. There are also supply chain issues and new safety measures, such as QR code menus and going cashless. We're going to talk about all this now with Farley Elliott. He's senior editor at Eater LA. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Well, restaurants getting the green light June 15th to reopen for indoor dining really felt like, well, we're back in business and the recovery is upon us. But in the last 3 weeks, how has it been for them?
You know, it's been a mixed bag. I think there is a ton of excitement, and deservedly so, that we're able to do away with so many of the traditional protocols we've been living under for the past 15 months. But ultimately, it's not a solve. You know, there's a lot of things that still need to be worked out. Part of that is staffing, and part of that is the rightful hunger of the dining population to want to go out and spend money again. But that comes with expectations and where they can sit and how fast they can be served and even how expensive things are. So there's still a lot to be done.
Right. And what about for customers? Are customers eager to return to eating indoors, or are they a little leery of going back to the way it was pre-pandemic?
You know, it's hard to pinpoint one specific subset of diners that is representative of the whole. I think there are lots of people who are absolutely comfortable dining in at restaurants. I've done it myself a few times, but it's a little bit of your mileage may vary. Thankfully, the city of Los Angeles and surrounding communities have done a really great job of building outdoor spaces and making those kind of previously unused sections of dining areas more functional so people can feel comfortable if they do still want to eat outside.
Right. And so these are new temporary measures that allow restaurants to do that. So they can open up on sidewalks, parking lots, streets. They call it LA al fresco. And that is set to expire September 1st. Any inkling as to whether that will be extended or even made permanent?
There has been a big push to make some of that, if not permanent, at least more long-term. And you've got to think there's a couple different things at play here. One is, you know, tables that got set up on a sidewalk in front of a restaurant, and that comes with complications for ADA law and access and things like that. City-built facilities and structures with those kind of K-rail Jersey barriers that are built into the street, those are probably set to stick around for a long time. And if you look at standalone cities with their own governance and public health departments, like the city of Pasadena, they went through and actually restriped entire streets to make it so that you could have seats in a safe way in the street. And I think that's going to stick around possibly forever, which is really good news for these places that have been able to, in some cases, double their available dining capacity.
And maybe that made the difference between staying open and going out of business.
It certainly has helped. You know, as you said before, they're facing a whole new slew of challenges with trying to fill all of those seats because staffing has been an issue, supply chains have been an issue. But there is at least hope that with the kind of numbers they're able to do, that long-term survival is viable.
Well, let's talk about the supply chain for a second. What's happening there? What shortages are restaurants experiencing?
Yeah, you know, it's really up and down. You've seen not only prices increase for basic commodity goods. Ask any person cooking barbecue in Los Angeles right now how much a brisket costs, and you'd be surprised at the answer. But it's also simple lead times for things. The shipping channels, all that sort of stuff has been so dramatically overhauled because of the pandemic. I've talked to chefs who can't even get plates for their restaurants that they're trying to open right now. And so it really is affecting every aspect of life.
Hmm. So they've had to change their menus, make them maybe smaller, offer fewer items?
Exactly. And changing service models entirely, you're going to see a lot more places continue to do, say, counter service during the day with a more traditional sit-down setup at night, or places that are thinking at the very outset that they're going to change their models. If you look at the new Crudo y Nudo in Santa Monica, they're essentially a collection of patio tables out on a sidewalk and a walk-in space that's only a couple hundred square feet. And they built it that way with the idea that they could keep overhead costs low and still be on a pretty prime street in busy Santa Monica. So we are seeing kind of retooling from the top down that can ultimately be good for restaurants in the city, but it is going to take some imagination, I think, on the diners and operators side to be comfortable with it all, because it's not what we're used to.
Right. And so one of the biggest issues, of course, restaurants just can't hire enough people to function 7 days a week. Where are all these workers that used to be in restaurants?
Well, you know, I certainly feel for operators who maybe take the short view and say that because the federal government has partially subsidized people to be on unemployment during the greatest economic crisis of our lifetime, that those folks are a little bit loath to go back to work. That's absolutely part of it. I think bigger parts of the conversation involve how the industry has traditionally underpaid its workers and passed those inexpensive monetary configurations onto menus because people don't want to pay $15 for a cheeseburger or something. So that's certainly part of it. You know, we need to create more equity in the industry. We need to create better pay within the industry. And that's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of buy-in from diners. And if I'm being perfectly honest, you've seen a lot of people that have realized that the industry is not for them. It does not serve their needs anymore. And they've moved on to other jobs entirely. Or to be perfectly honest, like 600,000 people have died. At one point in the pandemic, being a line cook in California was the most dangerous job you could have. There is a subset of this industry that is never going to return because they've passed away, which is the saddest part of all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Farley, thank you so much for the overview.
Yeah, thank you.
Farley Elliott, senior editor at Eater LA. I want to turn now to Carolyn Stein. She's the co-founder of the Luke Restaurant Group, which owns AOC, and she has other restaurants. She says all of them are understaffed and operating at reduced hours. Welcome to the program, Carolyn.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what has it been like trying to rehire at your restaurants? I believe you have four.
Yes, I have to say it has been one of the biggest challenges we have ever faced. And my business partner, Suzanne Gohn, and I have been in business for quite a while now. And even after getting through this last horrible year and a half, trying to get back and up operating at a normal pace has been basically impossible. I've never had such a difficult time trying to hire people. And it's holding back recovery across the board for restaurants around the country.
Are you offering higher wages?
You know what? We're offering competitive wages. We actually share our tips with the kitchen so that the kitchen staff benefits from the gratuities as well. So their wages have increased. You know, at this moment, it's not even so much about the wages you're offering. Everybody's competing against each other and basically offering the same thing. It's just the actual number of people available has been so reduced. That we're all fighting for the same, you know, 12 people who are applying for a job. We have people that, you know, come and apply and we call them in for an interview and they don't even show up.
Wow. And so what have your former employees tell you about why they don't want to come back?
Well, it's been a multi-pronged issue. A lot of people moved away. I mean, California lost almost 200,000 residents in 2020. Many of them were in the service industry. A lot of servers, you know, tend to be actors and people who are living shift to shift because they're subsidizing a future goal in their career. And so a lot of them moved home with their parents. Some people moved to less expensive states. They moved to Arizona and Oregon and Texas and places where it's just less expensive to live. So that's been part of it. There's definitely a bit of fear on the part of some of our staff to come back and actually be working with the public. We've had a couple of staff members who basically had panic attacks when they came back to work and had to retreat back home. I mean, everyone has PTSD from being locked away apart from each other for so long. And then there is that aspect of the unemployment benefit that a lot of people sort of feel like, well, at this point, I'm okay. I'm not spending money and I can get by without working. And that's a challenge too.
Right. I heard from my producer that you're even waiting tables or serving food. You're
so
short-staffed.
every one of us on the staff is doing whatever we have to do to take care of guests. And, you know, we want so badly to provide the level of service that that is our goal that we've always provided. But at this point, you know, we are struggling. We're trying to get as many people in the door as possible because we're all trying to dig out of this financial hole that we've been in since the beginning of COVID. And people are, you know, there is a demand for people to come in, which is amazing. But I almost want to temper people's expectations and just say, look, we are doing the best we can. We're all hands on deck. Yes, I've been running food and busing and running drinks and taking orders, which I've always done. But I think we're all doing it at a higher pace right now because we're just trying to do whatever we can to serve our guests.
And this all means that you've had to cut back on hours in service, right? So you don't serve lunch at some of your restaurants?
Absolutely. We just opened AOC in Brentwood, and we are only available to be open right now 6 nights a week. We can't even be open for 7. We're not open for lunch or brunch yet, which are major parts of our operating strategy. And, you know, for a restaurant, I mean, I think the one thing that happened through COVID was that it did lay bare sort of the struggles that restaurants have. Yes, the wages may seem low, but our profit margins are incredibly low because our financial structure is just completely out of whack. Our labor model is incredibly high compared to any other business. And, you know, guests don't want to really pay what the true cost of the food should be when you count the labor. That's why labor, you know, that's why wages are low. We're paying minimum wage plus tips. And it's frustrating, but for all of us, the only way to actually make money is by getting all of those service periods in and turning our tables and getting as many tables into the room as possible. And so when we're only able to operate, you know, fraction of our shifts and with reduced capacities because we don't have enough service to take care of people, we can't recover financially.
Wow. So it sounds like a chicken and egg thing. What are you going to do? And I, you know, what are you hoping will happen in the next couple of months?
Well, we're going to, you know, chip away at it and keep trying to hire. We're just constantly hiring. So as soon as we can get more staff in, we'll open a little bit more. You know, a lot of restaurants benefited from the restaurant relief package that was passed in the rescue plan that gave grants to restaurants. But that fund was depleted so quickly. It was only $28 billion, and there's still a need for $60 billion more to be put into this fund. So I know I'm part of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, and we are, you know, lobbying Congress and Senate to reload that fund because that fund will enable restaurants to get through this period until we do have more workers and we can recover. Because at this point, more restaurants will close, unfortunately. A third of them closed, but there are still restaurants that even though people are lining up to come in, they're still not able to pay their rent. So this is the big prayer right now.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world trying to work through all this and hope you keep your restaurants open. Carolyn Stein runs the Luke Restaurant Group. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Coming up, what the Olympics will look like with few spectators and why online learning could continue next year for some students. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. No spectators at the Olympics. That is the latest from Tokyo. Japan is dealing with a surge in COVID cases and has now declared a state of emergency. Just 16% of Japanese citizens are fully vaccinated. The Olympics begin in 2 weeks, and with me to talk about this is Henry Bushnell. He is a reporter for Yahoo Sports who covers the Olympics, and he's headed there later this month. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks. Well, what does this mean, that there won't be any spectators at all? No Japanese spectators, no foreign spectators?
Exactly. We have always known for several months now that there would be no foreign spectators. So it had come down to a decision of whether to allow Japanese to attend events. And there had been sky-high ticket demand, you know, pre-pandemic. But then the Olympics became wildly unpopular over there. But then there were still a lot of fans who wanted to go to events. And they announced a few weeks ago that they would open venues at 50% capacity. And then on Thursday, the Japanese government declared a state of emergency in light of rising COVID cases in Tokyo and a few other surrounding prefectures. So no fans at the vast majority of Olympic events. There's still a chance that there could be some fans at, you know, soccer, baseball, softball games, some of the events that are held elsewhere in Japan in areas that are unaffected by the state of emergency. But most of the events that you will be watching later this month and next month will be in empty venues.
And so the Japanese citizens, by and large, are pretty happy with this? They're pretty okay? Because I know that they were very concerned about the Olympics, or most of them were very concerned about the Olympics taking place and possibly bringing with it lots of COVID cases from abroad.
They're happy with this, and some would like to see things go a step further and see the games canceled altogether or postponed again. I believe a majority of Japanese citizens, you know, according to public opinion polls, still don't want the games to happen this summer, just because vaccination rates aren't very high over there. It's something like 15% are fully vaccinated. So there's still a lot of concern about the virus over there. And there's concern that the Olympics could lead to more transmission. And this will ease some fears, I think, of that. But there's still some wariness there.
Yeah. Well, I imagine all the athletes have to be vaccinated.
They don't. There's no mandate.
Oh, really?
The IOC has said that most will be vaccinated. And I think that's common sense. We know that based on my conversations with athletes, like, and what others have said publicly, the vast majority of U.S. athletes, for example, will be vaccinated, largely because if you don't get vaccinated, there's a risk of testing positive. And if you test positive, even if you're asymptomatic, you're out of competition and you lose this once in a lifetime shot at the games. So, but no, there's no mandate. And in fact, all of these wildly restrictive countermeasures are going to apply to everybody, no matter their vaccination status in Tokyo, and all athletes, no matter their vaccination status, will be tested daily and will be subject to all sorts of physical distancing restrictions and all of that.
Well, does that include other people like you, reporters and all the support staff?
It does. There's this, there's a whole tiered system. And so, you know, athletes and everybody who comes into contact with athletes regularly will be tested daily. So that'll happen daily for everybody, like all the really important people. Press, somebody like me, we get tested upon arrival and then each of the first 3 days, and then we do every 4 days thereafter. And then, you know, other people who are even less integral to the games are every 7 days. So it's this whole tiered system, and yes, there will be, you know, thousands upon thousands of COVID tests being done in Tokyo over the next month.
What about other precautions? Will people be allowed to go out to restaurants in Greater Tokyo, for example?
I am not even going to be allowed to walk out of my hotel just to go for a walk and get some fresh air. That's how strict things are going to be. The athletes aren't going to be allowed to do anything touristy, no restaurants, no bars, no sightseeing, nothing along those lines. It's really, you do what you have to do to serve your purpose in the Olympics. So for athletes, that's staying at the athletes' village, eating their meals there, taking a bus to their training venues or their competition venues, and then coming back. And it's really going to be the exact opposite of the festive atmosphere that you usually associate with the Olympics.
Speaking of festive atmosphere, at every Olympics, they usually expect the athletes to fraternize and, you know, maybe engage in romantic interactions. How are they going to prevent that from happening?
That's a bit unclear. They have encouraged athletes to not socialize with each other and refrain from even, you know, just hugs and high fives and stuff like that. How exactly they're going to enforce all of that in the Olympic Village with thousands of athletes staying there is not quite clear. And how strict the enforcement will be, it's unclear. They did say, I believe last month, that they're still handing out condoms to athletes. So maybe that's a hint at how strict enforcement will be. They say they're not for use in the Olympic Village specifically, but it obviously sends a message on its own. So we'll see. And I'm sure throughout the games, we'll get stories from athletes about exactly what the atmosphere in the Olympic Village is like.
Henry Bushnell, he covers the Olympics for Yahoo Sports. Henry, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we talked about expanded outdoor restaurant dining earlier. Here's another thing that could survive the pandemic: distance learning. Most California students will return to in-person classes this fall, but Governor Gavin Newsom and state legislators want all K through 12 schools to offer an option for remote learning. And joining us to talk about how this might play out is Guy Marzorati, reporter at KQED. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you back. Well, what does this entail? There has always been something called independent study for kids who have an illness or child actors, that kind of thing. What does this new version of independent study mean?
Well, I think it really starts from the point that the distance learning we knew throughout the pandemic is over. The law that allowed districts to set up distance learning in California expired on June 30th. But when it expired, that didn't wipe out the demand that some parents, some families had for remote learning for their kids, either for health concerns or perhaps they felt like they were getting a better education learning at home. So the demand was still there. And I think what you're seeing with this agreement between the governor and the legislature is a way to fulfill that demand beyond what independent study traditionally was, which was, you know, as you mentioned, child athletes, maybe child actors, they pick up a packet, a work packet, every couple of weeks. This new independent study program that's being put forward in the state budget would really put a lot more requirements around instruction, oversight, in the anticipation that it's going to be used by a lot more students than historically.
And would that mean Zoom again? Certain classes being offered via Zoom?
That's right. So this is, you know, going to be remote instruction, and there's going to be pretty minimal requirements on teachers to check in. But there still will be a daily requirement for teachers to check in with their students, either on, you know, remotely via Zoom or via phone. And then for some younger grades, there's actually going to be some requirements for instructional hours taking place live between a teacher and student. So for the youngest students in the states, you know, grades K to three, there's going to be about an hour a day required where the teacher has to be actually interacting with students. So, you know, that might sound like even less than we saw in a lot of cases in distance learning. But this is going to be offered as a way to, you know, I guess, placate the concerns that if we went back to a completely default system like we had before the pandemic, which is in-person learning would be the norm, would be the default, and there really wouldn't be any kind of robust option for students to learn outside of the classroom.
I mean, can anyone opt into this? Anyone say, you know, I don't feel comfortable being in the classroom, I want to continue remote learning? Anyone?
Yeah, and it actually, this bill actually makes it clear that students can use, you know, health reasons. If there's health concerns preventing them from going back in the classroom, that can be a reason to enter into this new independent study. There still would be a lot of off ramps. And I think the real intent behind this legislation from the authors that I talked to in the legislature was to make it, you know, as easy as possible for students to get back in the classroom, even if they initially opt to do this independent study to start with. So, for example, there's going to be requirements that parents meet with school administrators to really go over what this independent study would look like, you know, sign agreements. There is going to be different checkpoints, and at which point, if a student is not completing their work, handing in late assignments, this, you know, the independent study agreement would be reevaluated. And then I think an important clause in here says that if a student and their family feels like they want to get back to the classroom, they want to opt out of independent study, school districts would have just 5 days to make that happen. So I think everything that you're seeing in this legislation is providing kind of off ramps with the end goal, I think, by everyone in the state government of getting back as close to possible to in-person instruction.
Right. And so how did teachers feel about this? Because from what I understand, they were already overwhelmed and the possibility of added work when it comes to, you know, first they're going to be teaching their other students in person, and then they would have to also do this online component for an untold number of students. How are they feeling about it?
Well, actually, you know, the California Teachers Association says that they're in support of this proposal. And I think a key thing to understand here is the student-teacher ratios would be maintained even in this independent study program. So it's not going to be a scenario in which teachers are suddenly, you know, added on students who are learning outside of the classroom. You're still going to have the same teacher-student ratios. And I think the way the teachers' unions looked at this was, I think they felt a demand from parents, from some parents who felt like they wanted to have this other option. Maybe they were concerned that students, you know, who were unvaccinated or had some kind of medical issue, or maybe just uncomfortable going back to the classroom right away, that there would be this other option. And so when this proposal was released this week, we saw the CTA, the California Teacher Association, come out in support.
Well, do we know or have any idea how many students will do this and continue with distance learning?
We really don't have a good grasp on the demands. I mean, we've heard from some civil liberties groups. The ACLU has been advocating for this option. They say this, you know, feeling of wanting a remote learning option is particularly prevalent in Black and Latino families. And kind of given that demand, what was on the books for independent study didn't cut it. You know, historically, as you noted at the top, independent study was a really limited option. The data that the state has back in 2015 found less than 2% of students were getting most of their instruction through independent study. So the demand is likely to be more than that, but we just really don't know at this point what the demand will be.
Right. And this is just a year-long program. It's not.
That's right. And I think lawmakers are really looking at this as kind of a trial period, maybe even a transitional period, getting people more comfortable going back in the classroom. This will expire at the end of next June when it's time for the following year state budget. And I think, you know, there'll be time to reevaluate it at that point.
Guy Marzorati, he's a reporter for KQED. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, why white actors have worn blackface, but not the other way around.
Are Black people not as innocent then because we don't do that as part of our celebration? I think then that reveals that this is really just about power.
The author of a new book about the history of blackface, she's here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. When Ayanna Thompson's son was in the third grade, his class was required to do a big year-long project on an influential person in history. And at the end of the year, the students had to dress up as their chosen person. Well, Thompson was astonished as she walked around the classroom during the presentation to find that several of the white kids, not one, several, had dressed up as heroes who were Black and they were wearing blackface. These were 8-year-olds, and this was 2012. The incident sent her on a journey to explain why blackface is not acceptable, ever. And she's written a book that delves into the history of it. Ayanna Thompson is a Shakespeare scholar at Arizona State University, and her new book is called Blackface, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, describe that moment. Just describe your emotional reaction when you saw these kids in blackface.
Well, I should preface it to say that my little brown son was William Shakespeare for his hero, his special person. And we never had a discussion, nor did it ever cross my mind that he would need or want to wear white makeup to be William Shakespeare, right? So I was not only startled, but also wondered why the reverse wasn't true, why the Black and brown kids who had chosen white heroes, why they didn't think that they needed to apply racial prosthetics to embody their heroes fully. And when I spoke to the principal of the school after seeing the three children who were Serena Williams, Arthur Ashe, and Martin Luther King Jr. When I spoke to him about the fact that they were wearing makeup, he's like, I know, isn't it great? And I was like, wait, what? I was like, don't you think this is getting dangerously close to minstrelsy? And he said, what's minstrelsy? And I just thought, how is it that you don't know our shared American history?
So is this book for white people? Is this you shouldering the burden of explaining this to white people who don't understand?
Well, I think it's for everyone. I think it's pretty astonishing how many examples there are from the 21st century. This is not something in the Wayback Machine. And particularly in the early 21st century, if you were turning on late night television, you had as much chance to see a comedian in blackface as you did to see a black comedian. And so I think it will be powerful for readers of color to see it documented, how often we were being assaulted by these performances recently. But I do think probably more of the didactic elements of the book, like why we shouldn't do this, why you can't say that you think you're celebrating someone when you do this, or why saying it was back in 1980 isn't an excuse, right? So I think that that will probably be part of what happens.
Right. Well, so you're referring to Ralph Northam of the Virginia governor, who was famously called out for not one, but two instances where he was in blackface, and also Justin Trudeau, the prime minister of Canada. And both men said, oh, yeah, what you just mentioned, this was back in the 80s or way back when they were young and heedless youth. And they were doing it in an act of honor, really, that they were imitating the people that they really respected, Michael Jackson, for instance, in Ralph Northam's case, and sort of saying, well, it was just innocent admiration, and I just dressed up because I really liked this person and I wanted to look like him. What's your response to that argument?
Yeah, well, I don't think black people have ever gotten to be that innocent. Right. Like, I mean, that's what I mean, I think that reveals the inequity, the power inequity that exists in our country still today, where if your excuse was I was innocent, I was just doing something as part of a celebration, I think we have to say, so are black people not as innocent then because we don't do that as part of our celebration? I think then that reveals that this is really just about power.
It's about power. So even when you look at the little girl in your son's class who dressed up as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I mean, she couldn't have known the history of minstrelsy, the fact that it goes back hundreds of years, really, this appropriation. She couldn't have known that, really.
Yeah, no, she couldn't have known that. But part of what I do is trace all of the instances in which she probably would have encountered blackface on television between 2008 and 2012 when my son was in the third grade and this happened. But even if that's not the case, I think the point is she didn't do this on her own. She had to have some help from either her parents or her teachers or both. And the fact that there were three children who did this leads me to think that there probably was larger parental or teacher involvement.
Right. Now, it's interesting that your son played William Shakespeare because you trace the origins of blackface to Shakespeare and the Shakespearean time period as well. Others, other playwrights and other performances also employed blackface. But of course, the most famous of all would be Othello and how he has been portrayed. Can you talk about how blackface first came into being?
Well, there have been scholars who've done some work on classical plays, so Greek and Roman plays, where there's some speculation that racial prosthetics may have been used. But in the what we would think of as the contemporary world, they are depicting the wider world, right? Shakespeare's theater was called The Globe because this was part of a great age of exploration and encountering other peoples, other cultures, religions, and races. And so we get lots of characters who were portrayed with various types of racial prosthetics, from the use of oils to like fake Afro wigs, to fake noses, different types of costuming. So there were lots of ways of portraying different races on those Renaissance stages.
And explain, if you were talking to someone who maybe is from another planet and hasn't been aware of this, or maybe actually this planet and perhaps in your son's school, why it is bad to employ racial prosthetics. If you are on stage and you are trying to portray someone, and in those days they only had white actors, right, and men, women weren't allowed to be on stage, why was it bad, or why is it bad and offensive to employ racial prosthetics?
Yeah, I mean, the issue is that the first representations of Blackness, for example, are impersonations of Blackness, not a Black body that gets to be on stage and control the character that's created. And, you know, minstrelsy as its own performance genre, of course, was incredibly harmful because it was specifically created to denigrate enslaved people and the recently freed people who were had formerly been enslaved. So it was a way of mocking those African Americans who were forced into bondage. And so I think that performance tradition really stakes a claim on the ownership of performing Blackness. And I think this is why there are lots of hand-wringing among actors of color about how to perform their own culture, identity, being in an authentic fashion, because we have 400 years of history in which all of the characters of color were created by white people to be performed by white people. That's pretty hard to get out of.
Right, and you bring us up to date talking about Tyler Perry, and there is a robust debate over Tyler Perry, and I believe in reading your book, you come down on the side that what he's doing is harmful, that he is perpetuating stereotypes, and stereotypes that were created by white people.
Yes, I think for me, I think his films, which are incredibly popular and make tons and tons of money, and that he's been able to become an independent filmmaker, all of these things are great, but it's all on the back of what are basically minstrel characters. You know, Medea in his films, the part that he plays, the older Black woman, is straight out of a minstrel show where they make fun of Black femininity for being too big, for being unsexy, for thinking that she's sexy when her body is disgusting. I just feel as if to borrow those performance tropes, even when you're in control of the production of the material, seems to me damaging, and also showing us the limits of where we are in this moment in our ability to think about what performances of Blackness we want to see.
Well, who's getting it right? Who do you think is portraying Black lives now on screen in a way that actually captures them as full human beings?
Right, with complexities and desires. I think there's probably more getting it wrong than is getting it right, sadly. But there are some examples of, like, and so, for example, I talk briefly about Girls Trip, which I think is a terrible film, but, you know, hilarious. But the one comedic actress in it is so brilliant because she doesn't seem to care about a white gaze at all. Like, she's just zany in a way that I don't think we've seen many examples of before, that, and that's where I'm hoping we go. And I do think that.
And this is Tiffany Haddish you're talking about?
Tiffany Haddish, yes.
Mm-hmm. You better be, because I plan on getting white girl wasted this weekend, and I ain't letting none of you bitches kill my vibe, okay?
I mean, I do feel like there's probably like Black feminist humor that's going to get us out of this bind going forward. So I'm hoping that like the Tiffany Haddishes of the world write plays, movies, television shows, and they all get greenlit. maybe Tyler Perry will fund them.
But there's so much now. There's Black-ish on TV. There's Insecure. There are, you know, I mean, there are lots of movies now starring Black people and about Black lives.
Right. So I think we have had a pretty good, robust history of, you know, Black-made art, performance art. But what I'm hoping for is that they don't fall into these old performative traps. That I think even, and this is why, you know, I feel like it's the thing that we aren't allowed to say that much is that like, even when Black people make it, they can make it wrong. And that's where I'm really hoping, and Black-ish is interesting, and Black AF is interesting too, because I think that those are shows that are more about grappling with how hard it is to be authentically Black. And I think that that's still a trap, though, right? Like, I would like us to get to a place where that doesn't even have to be the question. You just get to be whatever kind of fully realized person, character you want to be.
The book is really a fascinating read and a quick read. It's a small book. Physically, it's a small book.
Yeah, physically a small book. And it's not written for academics. It's written for the everyday reader. And it, as you say, it's meant to be like a quick, fast read so that then you can just sit and think or talk about it with your friends. Or give it to the principal of your child's school.
Exactly. Well, Ayanna, it has been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much, Madeline. It was a pleasure.
Ayanna Thompson, director of the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies at Arizona State University, and her book is called Blackface. Well, as temperatures climb, eating fresh, cool lemon and melon is a great way to cool off. Evan Kleinman is here with some recipes next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Melons. It is melon season. And, well, you know the three big ones. Watermelon, cantaloupe, honeydew. There are so many other varieties, though. And here to talk about them is Evan Kleinman. She hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hello.
Hello, melons.
I'm in a bit of a melon fugue state right now, just thinking about them.
I know, they do that.
All right, well, how many varieties do we have here in Southern California?
I almost want to say we have countless because, you know, you take the big four. You have the green, the orange, the red, and the very light yellow or white. Uh-huh. And behind each of those are many, many individual varieties that have been sourced from all over the world. One of our farmers that we always look to for really quality product, Alex Weiser, for example, is bringing 9 melons to the market. I know that Munich has countless melons, and each one has its own characteristic within the family that it comes from. Because you know that green melons tend to have this wonderful, dense, yet super tender flesh that can be extremely juicy, like lead to one of those juice down the arm moments.
I know it can be a little too cloying and cloyingly sweet too.
See, honeydew. Some people find that, and so I don't find that. I love the green melons. So if you find them too cloyingly sweet, then you probably prefer an orange-fleshed melon, which tends to have a more consistent texture of flesh and is extremely aromatic, but less cloyingly sweet.
When you say orange flesh, aren't you just talking about a cantaloupe?
No, that's the amazing thing. I mean, as I look at this information sheet that Weiser Family Farms sent me, they have 1, 2, 3 different orange-fleshed melons, none of which are cantaloupes.
But cousins of the cantaloupe.
Yes, yes, they're all in the same family. But, you know, humans, we love to tinker around with things, and one of the huge kinds of tinkering that we've done is hybridizing foods. So we tend to play around with seeds and cross things until we get something that we love.
And can you only get these in farmers markets or specialty stores?
Farmers markets, for the most part, are the easiest place to get them. Grocery stores are starting to have different varieties. Like, you never used to see a, quote, personal-sized melon in a grocery store. But mm-hmm. you see them now, which, of course, is in response to these other varieties.
And by personal size, you mean like the baby watermelon?
Yeah, especially the baby orange-fleshed uh-huh. ones, like the Chanterelle from France.
All right, so let's talk about how you like to eat them, besides just straight up out of the rind. How do you serve melons? What are some good recipes?
Well, if you're serving to friends, I think the tried and true sweet fleshed melon with something salty and umami is always really great. I mean, that's why prosciutto and melon is such a classic, mm-hmm. and why I think salty cheese, like a cheese like feta, pairs so beautifully with melon. So you could easily make a melon salad with chopped up melon, a little bit of feta, and some mint, finely chopped mint, and maybe add some Marcona almonds. Mm. That would be delicious.
Without the Marcona, that is exactly what I had last night, with a little balsamic.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah. The other day, I grilled some halloumi cheese, which is a really delicious, super squeaky cheese of the kind that doesn't melt when you grill it. Mm-hmm. And so it's really fun to cut up and grill, and then you could serve it with melon, and that would be beautiful with balsamic vinaigrette or a vinaigrette that has citrus in it. And obviously, just lime juice and salt is yes. fantastic on melons.
You have to, when you make these salads, you have to eat them pretty quickly after you make them, otherwise they turn into soup.
Yeah, but then you can just whiz them up and call them a salty agua fresca.
Oh, what a good idea.
Because agua fresca, to me, is the thing to do if you have way too much melon or you're really, really hot and you want to sacrifice half your watermelon. And then if you want to go a step further than agua fresca, just take that delicious mixture of blended melon, lemon or lime juice, and maybe a little bit of water and throw it in the freezer, like we've talked before last year, and make granita. So I also have a link for everyone to remind them how easy that is to make.
Okay. And you can get that link at quesodelie.com, correct?
That's true. But I have to tell you that my favorite thing to do, Madeline, is take one of those personal-sized melons, pack it with vanilla ice cream, throw it in the freezer, and then have that for dinner.
Dinner? You just went straight to the dessert for dinner?
Yeah, why have the extra calories of the actual savory part of the dinner?
I know, the boring part. Just get right to the sweet. Forget the meat.
There you go.
Perfect. All right. Well, check out KCW.com for Evan's recipes and that link she mentioned to her granita recipe. Evan Kleinman is host of KCW's Good Food, and you can hear it on Saturday mornings at 11. Evan, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's always have dessert for dinner. All right. I'm Madeline Brand. That's it for us today. I'll see you tomorrow.